Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Rich Hills Golf Show podcast, episode 190, closing in on that 200 mark.
Yes.
If we're going to do something live, we've got to start planning it pretty soon.
You've committed to this. You said we definitely are. And you said you'll get me a little trophy as well for 200 episodes. So I'm looking forward to that. A little mini claret jug.
So we'll do our best. More information on potentially a live show coming soon. This episode.
Yes.
I think if people saw the title, they might go, ooh, this might be a very interesting one. We had a guest on.
Yes.
Last week, we were down at Woburn in Watford, kind of North London, and it's the home of Ian Poulter.
Correct.
Previous PGA Tour player, DP World Tour player, current LIV player.
Yes.
Captain of the Majestics. Mm-hmm. He is our first LIV player that we've had as a guest on the show.
Correct.
This is a really, really interesting interview. I found it fascinating. Now, just to give everybody a bit of an insight, we dive into a lot.
Yes.
It starts fairly kind of smoothly. And we, Ian is someone for me. Growing up playing golf, he was a huge inspiration from someone like myself, because his backstory of becoming a PGA professional or becoming a tour pro was the fact he used to be an assistant pro like me, yeah, like lots of other assistant pros. He did his PGA qualification like me at the Belfry. And so I always kind of, you know, always looked up to him to someone who's like, wow, he's taking it from, probably admit it himself, a fairly average player growing up, he's become a multiple tour winner.
Well, that's very interesting. A lot of people, a lot of people do know, many might not, that Ian Poulter famously turned pro of a 4 handicap, which is not uncommon if you wanted to go into the world of coaching or you want to become a club pro or whatever it might be.
YouTuber.
Yes. But to turn pro for 4 handicap and go on to even get on tour, never mind get on tour, retain a tour card, never mind retain a tour card, win European tour events, PGA tour events, is absolutely unheard of. However, in this podcast, we do ask him about that. And there's a bit more to the story of why he turned pro off 4 than people may think.
We also talked about his new life on tour, on LIV Tour, and what that means to him. The positives, and I quizzed him, grilled him on the negatives as well.
Well, that's something, again, many listeners, viewers of the podcast, certainly if you're a Clubhouse member or you've listened to a lot of the podcast, will know we've had very open opinions on LIV Golf, some of its pros, lots of its cons, etc. We've both kind of openly admitted we're not massive fans of it. We spoke about it. He gave reasons why he joined and why he likes it.
Much more honest reasons, I think, that we've ever heard from him. It's the most honest I've heard him say why he joined LIV. And I'm sure a lot of you people listening will guess why he joined, but it was nice to hear it from his own mouth. He was really honest. He was really great with his time. We also had the privilege of going out and playing an 18-hole match with him, a 10-shot challenge where I start 10 under par, he starts level. That will also be coming out soon, not this week, maybe next week. We also dived into Ryder Cup.
We did.
And his legacy. I mean, he is, from the Europe standpoint, a Ryder Cup legend.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, you wouldn't be too far off, I think, if you said in the UK that Ian Poulter is up there with a household, as a household name, certainly just among general sports fans. I'd find it very hard to believe you'd find, you know, if you've got 10 lads who like going watching football, out of those 10 lads who might not even play golf at all, 7-8 would know who Ian Poulter is, because a lot of people have interest in the Ryder Cup and he's been such a figure of that. But what was also quite interesting actually about this, before we get into the podcast, which as we said is a banger, on the way down to Woburn, I took Alex, who works with us, and he said to me, oh, who's a tour pro that you've met that surprised you, that was different to what you thought they were going to be like, in a positive or a negative way? And I kind of scratched my head a little bit and thought, you know what, most tour pros have kind of been what I expected. Adam Scott stands out as a guy who was even nicer than you could have ever dreamed of, wasn't he?
Oh, he was ridiculous.
Man. The perfect man. Lee Westwood was kind of how I thought he'd be. Lovely guy, quite dry, likes his banter. Kind of what you'd expect. I'd met Ian Poulter once before, very briefly with you, ironically at Woburn, for a few minutes chat, and he came across nice. I don't know if you've met him much before or...
I think I've met him once or twice. One of the times I met him, he was actually playing with our friend James Robinson in... the Open round.
Yes.
And I remember just chatting to him very briefly then, but not a great deal of dialogue with him. It's been a few interactions on social media, but not much. And before you come to your point, I know what you're going to come on to in a minute. I just want to make this super, 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 super clear. This was all done through me just DMing Ian. Like, this was not a staged or there was no... What's the right word? There was no affiliation to any tour to make this actual event happen. We were down at Woburn. They have their Titleist Performance Centre there. They're bringing out some new irons. I was going for an iron fitting. I thought, you know what? I know Ian's in the UK at the moment. I literally just DM'd him saying, hey, Ian, are you around? He said, yeah. I said, do you fancy filming? He said, let's do it.
And you missed out a bit there, though. I then sent some nice emails to get it over the line.
Well, obviously, but
I'm joking.
It started
completely. You slid into his DMs.
Yeah, it wasn't anything to do with any tours. It was just an opportunity. Absolutely. I thought, let's give it a go. But going back to your point about...
So what these pros are like. So what I went down, I'll be totally honest now, and I'm sure Ian's team have listened to this. I went down thinking that Ian would be a nice guy. I thought he would want to be there because obviously he'd agreed to it, like you said, just off his own back. But I kind of wondered, like, will there be, as you sometimes get with these guys, will there be a bit of a looking at the watch every now and again, how long is this going to be or whatever it might, you know, I wasn't fully sure what to expect. He's a successful guy who's been on tour for 20 odd years. You know, I didn't have a real expectation of what I was going to get. And honest to God now, I will go down forever now saying he was one of the nicest tour pros I've met. Such a family guy. He had his two sons with him, Luke and Josh, who, let's be honest, are a credit to him. Really nice, but nice lads, very well-behaved. I say well-behaved. How old's Luke's like 18, 19.
Yeah, Luke is going to be a baller. Yeah, he is really tall and looks like he's grinding like crazy. Josh is his youngest son, who's probably about...
I think he's 11.
He's like an excitable puppy.
That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
He is like an excitable puppy. Bless him. He was desperate to be on shoot. He sat in on the podcast. He actually features a little bit on the podcast. We also have a surprise appearance from the chef at Woburn on this podcast after
you got your wrist slapped.
Slandering their sausage rolls last time.
Yeah.
They wanted to make an amends. And I'm glad. So that comes up on this podcast as well. But yeah, Ian, he was really, really nice.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. I think the podcast you'll enjoy, a lot to listen to, a lot of little nuggets in there to take away. And the match, honestly, and this isn't just trying to big it up too much, your match against Ian Poulter, he starts level par, you start 10 under par, round Woburn, round the Duke's course.
His home course
was, in fact, I'm going to say it now, I think it was the best match you've had.
Wow.
I'm going to say that right now on camera.
So stay tuned for that. But before that gets released next week, sit back. And if you're not the biggest Ian Poulter fan in the world, give this podcast a listen to. Mm. Not saying it will change your mind, but it's definitely a different side of him that I'd never seen before. And I think a lot of people listening and watching are going to really, really enjoy.
And if you are the biggest Ian Poulter fan in the world, you're equally going to love it.
Love it.
And if you're somewhere in between, you're going to love it. So I think everyone's going to love this podcast. Everyone in the world is going to love this podcast. And if you do love this podcast, please do feel free to like the YouTube video, share it with some friends, but also on Apple or Spotify, rate the podcast. And again, share it with a few friends who might only occasionally dip into podcasts. push it towards them, force them to listen to it.
Let's spread the word. Right, sit back, enjoy this very candid podcast with Ian Poulter. So, Ian, thank you for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
To be honest, I feel like we're joining you because we're down here at your home golf course today here in the UK.
In the Poulter room.
In the actual Ian Poulter room. This is cool, isn't it?
Very nice. Yes, it's a great room. Got some memorabilia on the walls. I think we need to add a few more, to be honest. So Angus needs to give Woburn some additions to that. I think we need some majestic shirts and some bits and pieces in there.
It is, though. And to be honest, it's quite handy because just to the left here, we've got your career highlights too.
Oh,
so if
perfect.
We forget anything.
Yeah, they're still on a little small glass plaque.
There's quite a lot on
it's
there,
though. It's bigger than my glass plaque.
It definitely is. You know what? I want to dive into loads of things today. But one of the really interesting topics, obviously, we live in the world of social media. You were one of the first to the party of golf pros into social media. Actually, look, today it was like April 2009, you joined Twitter. Where did that come about?
I don't rightly know exactly where I was, but I think there was somebody else on tour that I saw had a social media page and was putting some reasonable content out. Now, I take tons of pictures, have been fairly vocal through my time. So I thought this would be a really cool avenue to kind of give people an insight into what we do day in, day out, because, you know, as what is the world of today is different to what it was 14 years ago. And more content, more cameras, more pictures, like people eat videos, media content. That's why you guys are here, right?
Exactly.
Because it's what everyone wants.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt that was a good opportunity, especially, you know, playing some great golf around that time as well, kind of 2009, 10, 11, 12, to be able to push some cool content to people.
Did it also feel like it gave you a platform to actually vocalize what you're thinking and actually, you know, be able to tell the truth, whether there was any media that you felt like you needed to rectify? Did it give you a platform you can go, right, you know what, if you want to know the true information, this is what I think?
Yeah, funny you say that, but there was a time, there was a quote in a magazine which really it pops up from time to time. You probably know exactly what it was, but you know, I was taken a little out of context in what I was actually saying and what I actually said. And obviously, like all good media outlets, right, there's always a way to shorten something or take a piece of that. And, you know, social media gives you that opportunity to actually correct it. It's never normally going to get corrected in the media, so you might as well be able to push it out yourself. So that was a decent opportunity and a place where I feel, you know, you could right a few wrongs in those certain terms and hopefully get your honest opinion across.
I think that's something, though, that I, as a golf fan, like to see, that we see these great golfers like yourself, you know, on tour, winning events, playing the PGA Tour. But to see golfers who actually actively use social media, it does help to grow a deeper fan base, because you feel like you get to know that person more and hearing their opinions and their take on things and their humour, etc. I think it definitely helps to build a real fan base. And I saw at the Open this year, actually, last year now, at the Old Course, the amount of people on the practice days that were chasing yourself for pictures and stuff, it was noticeable that you've obviously really built a hardcore following. Do you think social media has helped with that as such?
Yeah, I think I've done a decent job in the following that we've had, you know, to build a core audience, I would say, people that I can relate to, people that follow me for not just my golf, but other general family interests, what we're obviously into off the golf course, you know, stuff that I like to push out to people. And, you know, too many pages, in my opinion, are just done by other people.
Yeah.
Now, I can't do every single post. Now, Angus, who helps do our social media, does all the video editing and all the cool stuff that I simply can't do. And obviously that gets, you know, pushed out at times, you know, on our page. But you know, 90% of the stuff that I do, whether it's pre-warming up or practicing, that I push out, I'm pushing it out myself. So there are too many people, in my opinion, that don't give the real look mm-hmm. from themselves. They don't even look at social media, which, you know, I don't get that side of it. But for me, to have an audience that I relate to, I don't respond to every message because it's just simply impossible. Too much, there's just hundreds. You'll have exactly the same.
Exactly.
Some people get offended when you don't respond, but there's just nothing you can do. But, you know.
I also think people appreciate when you do get opportunity to respond.
Yes.
So, you know, if you responded to everybody, doesn't maybe, one, it's impossible to do. And also, it wouldn't feel quite as special where when you do get an opportunity to say thank you to someone or like a tweet, it carries a lot of weight. Mm. And you can tell your social media is done by you. You know, certainly your Instagram stories, it's obvious you holding the phone, you talking, you know, it's all of those nice touches that I think you're right, more people with social media should try and do. You know, it's not, I think a lot of players maybe got into social media because of other aspects where you can really see your social media kind of passion, really.
I think a lot of it is just to keep sponsors happy, and it's very corporate and it's not really showing you the inside their life. And like you said, that I think, and we've seen it, we'll come on to, I'm sure, like the Netflix documentary, seeing behind, you know, what's really people's lives are like. It definitely helps me anyway become more attached to golfers and root for them and want them to win because I feel like I know them a bit more.
Currently, you're back in the UK. Do you miss home soil? Is it nice to get back home, taste some nice bacon? I know you love a bit of English bacon and HP. What do you miss most about?
Listen, I'm on somewhat of a fitness kind of.
Oh, is that the wrong thing to say to you at the moment?
I'm trying really hard because I've lost about 20 pounds in weight, which needed to go.
Very good.
I was way too heavy last August coming back from the UK.
Yeah.
Spent a little bit of time at Woburn eating, you know, all sorts of great home foods. And, you know, it got me definitely way above my weight of where I wanted to be.
Vice team weight.
206 pounds, which is heavy. So I've shed all of that decent weight. I added some last week in Italy on a family holiday, but I'm now back in shed mode. But, you know, I miss home comfort food. Mm. Stuff that I grew up on, you know, eating curries and Chinese and occasional fish and chips and sausage sandwich and bacon sandwich and all of that stuff. I mean, it's just, there's nothing like it. When you're home and in and around home, it's, you know, you can't beat a packet of pickled onion monster munch.
Is that you?
No, but they're in the cupboard, so you just got to have that. You just have to have a pack, don't you? I mean, like there's a little jar on the side that Katie always keeps full of the, you know, just small chocolates, and there's dairy milks and fudge and whispers and all of that. You know, you walk past and you got to put your hand in the little cookie jar and you have a,
of course you do,
have a bit of chocolate.
Can you get most of the stuff in the US?
Actually, there is a website for that.
Oh, right.
Yeah, there is a, it's called EnglishShop.com, I think it is. And you can get anything and it's delivered within a week. And occasionally I'll go home and it's delivery time and this humongous box of Cadbury's and Walker's crisps. I mean, you name it, it's in there. I mean, you know, jars of pickle and like, it's, you know,
the best.
It's like a little touch of UK heaven's arrived on the doorstep. It's amazing.
And what about the family? Obviously they've spent most of the time, certainly the kids in the US, do they still love the little English treats? Have you managed to get the boys on the English? You've got Josh there nodding in the background.
Oh, look, he, like, we have a snack cupboard like we do in America, but back home here, and, you know, he eats probably half of his dinner and then the rest of the night he's just straight in, you know, what we'd say is like a little tuck shop in the kitchen, and it's hula hoops and he loves a packet of hula hoops.
Who doesn't?
I mean, so yeah, I mean, they just, you know, you know, eating, I mean, it's a summer of sugar. And it's quite funny when we always come back to America and they go and see the doctor and just for a checkup, and they jump on the scales and like, you can see this like blip of the weight increase once they've come back to the UK. So,
see, I go the other way. It's when I go to the US. Yeah, I find there's way too much temptation out in the US. I find it so,
I'm exact opposite.
Really?
Oh my goodness. Awesome. I find it impossible to eat well in America. Maybe because it's quite novel and you think, well, I've got to try a Chick-fil-A or I've got to go to,
Chick-fil-A's good.
Cheesecake Factory.
Oh no, can't stand it.
The portions are astronomical.
They're for four people.
That's what
they're astronomical. Oh, so I shouldn't have had two portions. They're absolutely astronomical.
Well, having said that, if you lived in the States in the warm and that heat, would you not be more motivated to get up to go for a run, to train, to eat a bit healthier?
If you live by the beach, potentially. You got to get the beach body out every now and again, potentially. You know what? I was going to come on to this later, but I think it's a nice point now. You know what I really love seeing on social media with yourself, and certainly I'm a family man. Guys recently had a little girl as well, just over Christmas time. How amazing you are with your family on social media. Like it's really nice to see. It's certainly things that when we did watch the Netflix documentary, my wife watched it with me, and your episode, she was like blown away how lovely of a family man you were. And it's so evident to see, like, Joshua's here, Luke's here. They're obviously to some degree following.
Because they want to hang out with you. They don't want to hang out with me.
they obviously seem super keen to be following your footsteps as well. I mean, Luke looks like an incredible golfer at the moment.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be in and around my family at all times, and you know, being on the road for 28 to 30 weeks a year for the last 25 years has not been easy. And I think, you know, the guilt that you have sometimes when you're on an airplane, you haven't played very well. You're traveling, you know, hours and hours and hours to get back home. There's something about family, which kind of brings it all back, that, you know, missing birthdays, missing nativity plays, missing competitions, missing kind of big milestones in their kind of upbringing, which you're never going to be able to get those memories back. You know, it means that I want to spend as much time with them as I possibly can. So I'm a bit closed shop as a housey guy who wants to be at home and be in and around them as much as I possibly can, because, you know, Amy's 21. She's obviously at college. Luke's at college at University of Florida, albeit he's 2 hours away and he pops back at weekends to get some of his laundry done sometimes.
Of course he does.
Because mum's too good at it, right? but, you know, before we know it, those two are going to be out of the house. They're going to be doing their own thing. They're going to be working. Either Luke's going to be playing golf. Amy's going to be on to a job somewhere, and she's going to have her own life. So, you know, I've kind of, this game of golf has passed me by already so quickly in 25 years that I've kind of missed too much of their time. So because I can't get any of that back, I just want to keep as much time as I possibly can within reason with them. And that's why I treat family time very, very special time. Family holidays last week was amazing for me. Just to, you know, to really enjoy them and seeing them have a good time and help them in their journey of whatever it is they're going to do.
Do you feel the last 2 years since joining Live has helped you free up weeks and days to spend more time with family? So I'm guessing that was part of a lot of players' motives, was to get more time back, spend a bit more time with family. Have you found that over the last 2 years?
Yeah, we're in a summer schedule right now, which I don't believe I've had 9 weeks in the UK and only have a commitment to play 2 weeks. So 7 weeks off in the UK will be the longest time I've ever had in 25 years in the UK to enjoy family, friends, proper holiday time, bit of downtime, gym work, practice. Like this, you know, this opportunity with this summer schedule has been refreshing, to be honest. You know, when I look back to, you know, on the board behind Guy there, 1999, and we're 2023. So all of a sudden, you know, I look at that, you know, all of those events that I've played in all of those years, and there's not much windows where we get an opportunity to have a bit of a refreshing break. So, you know, that's the beauty, I think, for us, for Liv, is having a 14-week schedule, which we know exactly where we're going to play. We know exactly what day we're traveling out. We know exactly what day we're obviously coming home, and you can pre-plan, pre-book.
Yeah.
T team travel, and give us the opportunity to have these breaks and windows, which are, I think, good mentally, you know, to be able to have those downtime windows to really refresh, recharge, get some other family, good quality family time in.
Yeah.
To be able to come out, you know, fit, strong, ready to go.
That's interesting you say that, though, because, like, obviously when people look at yourself and, you know, many, many elite tour professionals, they're living our dream, because we all listen to this podcast and watching this podcast play golf and would love to have a living playing golf at these amazing golf courses for amazing prize money. But equally, like you've said there, you've obviously had to sacrifice missing out on a lot of things with your children. And it must feel like sometimes it is a price to pay. And then having that more time now at home must feel kind of invaluable, really.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's priceless, and I'm not going to sit here and say we haven't done well for ourselves in the way I've provided for the kid. So, look, you know, I've earned a lot of money in my career. It goes without saying, and to be able to for me to provide for them in a way that, you know, 25 years ago, thinking back, that I could be in this position. Would be a fairy tale. Yeah. So there are sacrifices that you have to make in doing that, to be able to spend that time away from home. So for the guilt that you have for being away and missing, you know, lots of milestones, obviously you want to be rewarded as much as you can and obviously, you know, go home and provide for your family the best way you possibly can. So, you know, I don't feel guilty about, you know, being able to go and compete for large quantities of money, because, you know, we've trained hard, we've worked hard in 25 years of yeah. training to go and play to provide for what really matters the most to me, and that is family. So, you know, if I had to give it all up today to spend more time with the family, that would be something that I could definitely consider doing, because the family mean more to me than any job or any sport,
of course,
or anything.
Well, one quick question I had, and I hope you don't mind me asking this then, but, you know, look at that board there, your first win was 1999, and obviously today is 2023, you're still, you know, the top level of professional golf. And I think your story, which I'm sure we'll come on to, I'm kind of jumping ahead a bit, is something that a lot of people will know. You turned pro off a 4 handicap, you were like working at a golf club. And
which, by the way, just on that, was you actually a 4 handicap? But were, but were you actually playing to a 4 handicap, or were you not much better?
Wikipedia might tell a lie, but it says that you didn't play comps because the pro you're working for made you pay a green fee. Is that true or false?
Well, there's lots of kids watching, so I can't say what he actually really was. But yeah, my boss wasn't very nice at the time. So I stopped playing golf competitively. Not that I really played any much competitive golf even before then, but basically the age of 17. Mm. And... you know, my boss made it difficult to have time off to go and play in competitions. I didn't play in medal competitions, basically because it was expensive. I had to pay a green fee to go and play and enter a medal. So I stopped doing that. So my handicap at the age of 17 was 4.
But what do you reckon what do you think it was?
Well,
you must have been plus 2, plus 3, plus 4.
The lowest handicap I got to was 4. However, I practiced my backside off. I was on the range before work, after work, during lunch times. Yeah. I'd have a quick sandwich, go straight out and hit a bucket of balls.
Didn't charge you for balls?
No, that was the one thing that was free. So that's what I hit a lot of. I hit a lot of balls.
You were like, I'll show him. But I was like, more balls.
Yeah, but I used to, like, you know, for instance, you know, Mark Litton, who's a, you know, he's a European Tour chief referee today. He was played on the European Tour for a couple of years. He was at my club, and I used to drive him to the airport to get him to go away, and he'd give me a dozen golf balls, right? So that was a little bit of, you know, how I got my golf balls to play golf from the age of 17. But which he got for free, by the way, but he'll hate me for saying that. So
what balls did they back in? Was it a tall Bellata?
They were tightness, yeah, tall Bellata. So, Yeah, I pay for my fuel. I drove him to the airport and he gave me his 36 golf balls. Brilliant.
That, that's how Rick pays us. We don't get paid. I get paid in Pro V1s.
Pro V1s? I thought they were still tour professionals.
But just on that though, this leads me perfectly actually into what I was going to ask you originally, that you've got this kind of quite humble background and hard work and dedication, like you just said, then hitting ball after ball after ball to get to where you've got to. And I think there's not many tour pros can get to that level without grit, determination, hard work. Your son, Luke, obviously, as you said, he's currently at university, at college, golfing. And then obviously, from what I've seen on social media, is doing very well and excelling at that. How have you balanced parenthood then, in the sense that you kind of, I don't say came from nothing, but worked to where you get into? And obviously, the position you're in now, you can provide for your children, which obviously most parents would love to do. How has he got that work ethic as well, and has he really worked hard himself? Does that come from you? Have you taught him that? Because you could look at it and say everything's on a plate for him, but the way he's performing at his golf, he must be grinding.
He is grinding. He works hard. The nice thing for, he's not in the room, but I mean the nice thing for me with Luke is that he wants to be himself. Mm. And look, it's going to be difficult. He's always kind of going to be Ian's son in a way, which is difficult. So the advantages that has is also disadvantages as well. And, you know, the disadvantage for him is the fact that he knows he's going to have to work harder to be able to get out of that shadow situation to become his own individual. So I'm proud the way his work ethic is. I'm proud how he, when he puts his mind to stuff, he's capable of doing really good things. You know, to get a position at University of Florida is not easy. He got accepted in as someone that didn't play tons of, you know, tournaments leading in. I mean, today's kids just seem to play tournaments every single weekend of the entire year. Luke didn't really do that. So the coach saw a level of talent that he had and wanted to bring him into the team. He didn't play officially on the team last year. It was a very senior team and they won the NCAA championships, which was pretty cool. But, you know, he's going to be in a position coming up in a few months' time where he's going to be fighting to get himself into that team, which is good because it's pushing him. Yeah, he knows he's been on the outside. He's seen the success that the team have had this year, and it's, you know, it's really making him hungry. So he's committed. He works hard in the gym. He's actually got a six-pack, so I need to shed a little bit more now so I can actually uncover mine if there's actually one under there. But he's self-driving me too. So I think I've driven him.
Well, you set by example. You lead by example. Like he'll be seeing the hours and the hard work that you put in at the driving range, in the gym, on the short game area, on the putting green. He knows what it'll take, won't he?
I suppose that's credit to Luke as well, though. Because I guess if your dad was Ian Poulter, you could almost go, oh, okay, I don't really need to work that hard. I don't know. I feel like he must see what you've instilled in him and feel motivated, and he has to, because like you said, although his name helped to some degree, that's not going to get him on the team. He has to be the golfer he's got to be to get that shirt and get on that team. So fingers crossed this year he gets on that team and the team go on to win again. It'd be awesome.
It'd be amazing. I mean, he's in a wonderful college. You know, Coach Deacon is an incredible coach and obviously proven that this year with the rest of the team. But yeah, I mean, it's that extra piece that he needs to find, which is going to make the big difference. I mean, he went out and shot 11 under on the Dukes the other day. So
11 under.
And then the simple fact of he goes out to qualify and he didn't qualify for the amateur.
Right.
So, you know, it's finding a way to pull it together. So he's got the game. He's got everything it takes to go and compete at a very high level. I know because I've seen him hit it.
Is he beating you yet?
And he's never officially, but we don't actually play that much in terms of full rounds of golf as a full.
Does he always want to play your stroke play as opposed to match play?
No, he's stroke play. No, so, you know, I give him these small windows of opportunity when we do occasionally play to take me on. And I mean, he shot the same score as me three times, but he hasn't kind of got over the line. So it's about understanding how to piece it together at the right time. It's great going to shoot 11 under casually, because not many people have ever probably been in that position. So I know how talented he is. It's about him finding what makes him do that when he when he has to do it and when he needs to do it.
Yeah.
It will be exciting to help him try and find that from within, because, you know, there are so many great golfers in the world that I've played with in 25 years and that are capable to go and shoot 11 under par. There are not many people that are capable of doing that under tournament conditions.
It's funny you say that, because we've had a luxury, and obviously today's going to be an amazing video where Rick takes you on around Woburn.
I will not be shooting 11 under par today, by the way.
I'm starting 10 under par, yeah, and I still won't be shooting 11 under par.
But we filmed some amazing athletes, and we've watched like Minwoo Lee up close, Adam Scott, who hit the ball so well.
Sam Horsfield. Who's obviously a majestic, has been on the channel.
Flusher.
Yeah, correct. But we've also filmed some kind of much, much lesser known tour pros or guys who actually had to leave the tour because they've not made it. And we've watched them up close and honestly scratching our heads as to how on earth are you not on the European Tour winning week in, week out? But it's like you said, it's one thing doing it, even on a video, a fairly easy course, quite chilled. The pressures of doing that for your mortgage, 72 holes, week in, week out, it must be different.
That's what switches me on.
Mm.
Casual golf doesn't. So I could go and shoot 80 today. But, you know, casual golf for me is... It's a social piece for me. It's not actually any form of practice. Like, I do all my practice as a visualization on the driving range. When I go and play golf casually, I don't generally play golf casually. Very rarely do I actually play a round of golf.
So in like a practice round, how do you stay motivated?
Do you have little side hustles or anything? I struggle. Really? I really, really, really struggle, yeah.
Even if it was a side hustle with like Westwood or Stenson or Horsford.
Well, we have a bit of a game going at the minute. So it's the two oldies versus generally the two young ones. And Westy and I have fended them off every single time so far. And that's a lot of matches. But again, that is a piece of, you know, that's fun to me, because that's almost like a semi-pride match.
Yes.
Right. I mean, it's $100, but it's not the $100.
It's the winning.
It's the actual fact of it being, you know,
bragging rights,
beating the other guys.
So if you were here today and Sam Horsfield turns up and he gets you and says, "Ian, I'm going to beat you today. I'm going to beat you. I'm going to destroy you." Is that what gets you going? That right? I'll show you.
Yeah, it's a fire. I mean, that would be.
That
I mean,
fires
he
you
needs
up.
To give me a bit more notice just to make sure I'm ready for it. Right? But it's a case. For me, life's one massive game. It's been a massive game from my whole childhood. Sport has been everything about me in the way I grew up. So everything has to be a part of competition, and I want to win every single competition I play.
Mm-hmm.
So during all of my days, I want to do everything I possibly can to win at everything that I try and do. So
we need to get you riled up then, because I feel like you're taking today's game quite relaxed.
I've just come off holiday.
Well, let me set the scene then. Today, you're taking on Rick Shields around the Duke's course, am I right?
Yep.
He starts 10 under par, you start level par. So far in this series, you've played against Tommy Fleetwood, and the result was?
Well, we don't have to go through everyone. So far, I've played Tommy, Adam Scott, Lee Westwood, Ricky Fowler.
Yes.
And I've not won a single one. Okay,
so if Rick beats you today, you will be the first one he's beaten. So you can't
don't,
have
you
that.
Don't need...
Ian Poulter can't.
Stop,
I'm not having that on my
poking
watch.
Stop poking his fire. You don't need to stoke the fire.
Rick will not beat me today.
Perfect. That's what I want to hear. The postman's here.
God, great. Thanks to that guy. I feel like, did we say 10? I think I need 20 shots. You know, one of the things I did want to very quickly touch on, where did your passion for fashion come in? That's sounding quite good.
Passion for fashion?
Yeah, where did that kick in? Because obviously, if someone said, describe Ian Poulter, even now, you get checkered pants, crazy outfits. That's an iconic image for you, isn't it? Where did that all come from? Is that from a young age?
I worked on a market stall as a kid from the age of 11. So working within... selling really dodgy, bright, colourful shell suits.
And did you have to wear them?
Selling, no, I didn't, because they were minging. But selling three T-shirts for a tenner, you know, merchandising all of the stock in order of sizes, you know, small to extra large, and loving how Seve presented himself on the golf course, Payne Stewart, Jasper Parnovic. You can go through the players, you know, of old that you would have kind of, you know, recognized or followed as a kid, and say they all looked good on the golf course. They were all their own individual personalities, and they all, within their own right, dressed pretty cool. Mm. So the first couple of years on tour, I didn't feel comfortable enough really expressing myself in the way I would love to, A, from a financial standpoint, B, from a standpoint of being able to feel confident enough to...
Well, in a weird way, do you put a target on your back? If you rocked up your first season, rocking the checked pants, rocking the outlandish outfits, you'd kind of put a bit of a target on your back there, wouldn't you?
1,000%.
I think we've got a delivery for you, Ian.
Oh, chef. Chef.
So this is...
Paul's not shaking my hand.
For those listening, it is lunchtime as well. Great timing, by the way. I mean, you only make 800 of these a week, right?
About that, maybe 1,000.
Thousand.
I didn't realize how.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how beefy the chef was.
You don't want to mess with Paul.
I mean, look, these woven sausage rolls, not only do they smell unbelievable, you won an award last week.
We won an award.
Best sausage rolls.
So, for everyone listening at home, Rick, Paul's just brought in some sausage rolls. Why is that, Ian?
What have you put in it?
Give us some context to why there's some sausage rolls in here.
Right, so...
For people listening at home, there's 10 sausage rolls on the table.
A few weeks ago...
Ian's digging in.
No, do it properly. Give us a bit of description.
Tell us first why we're doing this, Rick.
I'll hold your mic.
So...
What can you tell me you think about the sausage rolls so far?
Woburn is pretty famous for the sausage rolls. Joshua absolutely devours them. He's actually dying over there
Come
and get one, Josh. They're famous. They're famous for putting weight on, like I proved last summer, going home 206 pounds. But there is a process to how they make these, and the caramelized onions that are kind of left to simmer for, I think it's 24 hours, as they're just kind of caramelizing, marinating, right? And there's a whole process. They lightly cook them first, and then they are absolutely amazing. So apparently you had one and you bagged it.
I sure did. Because you know what? Truth be told, I want to cut back to the video.
Yeah.
They did not look like that.
Okay.
So halfway round, we played on the Marquis course a few weeks ago. We went to the halfway house.
Yeah.
Listen, Ian, I was bloody excited about this sausage roll.
Yeah.
I've had Woburn sausage rolls in the past and I've not been disappointed. Okay. I turn up. I order a sausage roll, okay? It comes. It does not look like those sausage rolls. It was pale in existence. Now that does look like a sausage roll.
That is a sausage roll.
Right, I think you need to retry one, Rick.
Okay, go on then, Ian. Tell me, describe it for...
Oh, it's just gone straight in.
Get that sound in there.
Come in. Really hot.
That's why he said it's for me, that one. That one's just come straight out the oven.
Hot.
Give us a rating. Ian can't play this afternoon. He's got tongue burn. I'll wait for mine
crunchy
to cool down.
On the outside.
Yeah.
The pastry's crispy crunch on the outside. The sausage is nice and moist and hot.
And then you taste onions.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You get the little onion kick at the bottom. Okay. I mean, it's absolutely magnificent. It's magnificent. Come on,
what's funny, there's someone driving the car right now who's listening to this podcast thinking they're going to hear Ian Poulter talk about his PGA Tour life, winning on tour. They're actually hearing him devour
and
sausage roll.
And his new future in Live, and they were smashing a sausage roll. It does look a better colour than when I last reviewed it.
Very hot, by the way, careful.
I like the little kind of sesame seeds on top.
Yeah.
Generally, I'd like them bigger.
Yeah, you've said that before.
But if it does its job, then it's the perfect size.
Correct.
I would like it a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
But as we all in general, it does look quite good.
Smell?
It does smell good. This isn't the same sausage roll I had. This
just
is much, much better.
Rick.
No.
Careful, it's hot.
Some water if you need it. Better? So this is quite dead space now if you're listening.
Outrageously better.
Oh.
It was
going up.
That isn't the same sausage roll I had. That is outrageously better. I'm going to give that a solid.
Go 9. Come on, be generous.
No. But it's in the 8. Great, so 8.5. It's an
8.8.
Okay,
8.8. Very good. Josh, so, yeah. You're saying, dude, going for
10. Chef will be absolutely delighted with that.
Yeah, that is a definitely better. I'm really glad that my notes were taken on board.
Yeah. No, I mean, listen, if...
And Paul's come back and smashed it out of the park.
He's going to smash you out of the park in a minute, mate.
We'll get an award made up for him.
I'm sorry, Paul.
He's waiting for outside.
On a serious note, though, with that, the facilities here at Woburn, we've been blown away. We were here a couple of weeks ago. We did some filming. Me and Rick played a Texas Scramble around the Marquez course. We've been today to do a bit of tightless testing on the range. What a facility that is, by the way. That
amazing.
The range is
really
pure.
Good. Yep.
And the staff all here have been great with us as well. So it's a great place. I can kind of see why you call it home. But why is it that you do call this place home? Is it somewhere local to you? Or
It's meant a lot to me through the years. So I obviously worked Leighton Buzzer Golf Club, probably 3 miles down the road from here. And early 2000s, when we was in a position to obviously play on tour, come and do some more practice, the range obviously at Leighton Buzzer was too small. I've always kind of been up and around Woburn. We were in a position to come and become the touring professional back in the day. And to have three courses that have all meant a lot from tournament golf, because they've all obviously been a part of tour golf for quite a long period of time. You know, each and every course in their own right is different, difficult, tree lined, Duchess being super tight. A course that's a bit shorter than the rest. We're going to go and play the Dukes in a minute, which is probably of all three, the one that everyone remembers.
Yeah, it's a really nice course.
You know, really great golf course. I've been up here watching Seve and Monty and Faldo and Woozy and
some great winners here.
Amazing winners. amazing. And obviously you've got the modern of the three, you know, on the Marquess course that Justin beat me on. I finished runner up to him in the British Masters a long time ago, which is longer, a little bit wider, a little bit more friendly off the tee.
Was that the one like in 2015?
No, it was back in about 2004.
Didn't you host one about 2015?
I did. And that was on the Marquess course.
Yeah. I played in the Pro-Am.
Just a quick one. One thing we didn't finish before the Sausage Rolls came in was your fashion. So you got on tour. You weren't wearing too much flamboyant stuff, understandably so. You're the new guy on tour. Then how did it start to creep in?
I was in a position with my clothing where I could design my own kind of trousers and start looking a little different. I had a sponsorship deal at the time, which it was with Adidas, and I wasn't really a massive fan of their trousers, to be honest. So it kind of started from the trousers and it kind of went a bit from there. We started making one-off trousers down in Savile Row, London.
Was it William Pink?
It was back in the day.
Yeah.
So he started to make these trousers, which I've still got most of them today in a box, which would make some nice curtains for somebody, I'm sure. But it kind of went from there. So the whole tartan theme went on there. I wore the Union Jack in the Open Championship, which went berserk. We did Stars and Stripes. We went across the board in terms of covering every form of possible color, pattern, fabric.
Nothing was off the radar.
Top in pockets, side pockets, double. I mean, you know, big flare bottoms, slits in the side. I mean, we tried it all, really. Plus fours at the Open.
The Arsenal shirt.
The Arsenal shirt in 2006, iconic. I think that was.
Good call, that shirt. I like
the
that
burgundy.
Shirt. I like that one.
It's nice
change,
with the gold O2 middle, which apparently.
Exactly, it was college you were allowed to wear it.
I wasn't allowed to wear it. All right, fair enough. I got a slap on the wrist for that.
Nope.
But I mean, look, today I don't think I would have got a slap on the wrist.
No.
I think it'll be okay. Apart from that O2 logo was probably a bit too.
Yeah.
Bit too big.
Yeah.
But today you can almost get away with anything, right? I mean, Tiger wore the mock turtle collar for a long time, which changed. And, you know, it's all right for Ricky Fowler to walk around with his shirt untucked and look really cool, but you can't wear a shirt with a collar.
I have you to blame, though, Ian, to be honest with you, because about 2003, 2004, 2005, I was at the peak of my junior days. And I loved how you dressed, but unfortunately I didn't have the ability to go to Savile Row and get trousers. So I had to go to Next and get pinstripe pants and white belts.
Yes.
I then used to wear my hair and visor like you did.
Yes.
And I'd spike it up. But then the problem was...
Have you got the old picture of this?
Yes.
I need to see the picture.
I'd come into the clubhouse then and I would take my visor off, but because the rest of it was gelled, it looked horrendous. The front bit was all flat.
Yeah, top, it looks not good, like, is it?
I was a skinny, spotty 14-year-old. It wasn't a good look. Yeah. And then once I actually went to the Open in 05 with my friend Ben, and I wore my most elaborate loud stuff to try and, because you were playing that one, to try and get you to see me.
Oh.
You didn't do. So.
You have always done well with your hair, considering you wear visors. In like, it always looks good when you take it off.
You've got more
more than I've got, don't worry. As in like, when you take it off, it always looks good still.
Yeah, how do you do?
Give some top tips. I don't know if it does. Well, I receded quite a lot at an early age. So I think it's because my hairline goes back a bit and the visor sits
on the
front of that. It don't quite mess it up. Or I wore it messy enough.
Yeah.
But when I took it off, it didn't make any difference anyway.
It'd be interesting to know your take on this. When you released your clothing line, it was really successful. It went everywhere. It went in loads of different pro shops.
Yep.
But from my understanding, that kind of clouded your judgment off the course and affected then your playing ability on the course. Would that be right in saying that?
Having any form of business is not easy. I think where we were as a business in, you know, my vision for the business was produce a clothing line for everyone. Let's turn it into a really big business and let's have some fun with it. There was a number of things along the way that we did and we learned very, very valuable, expensive lessons from, you know, running before you walk in is one that I would say, you know, we we went straight in and we ended up doing ladies too quickly. We did juniors too quickly. The amount of SKUs that we did across the board in terms of how many different styles and colors per, that was a challenge. Selling into pro shops.
Yeah.
Is a challenge.
Of course it is.
It's often the way it's presented in store. Like, no offense to some, this shop here is a different level, but some of the pro shops around the country don't display product how you'd want it to be displayed.
Oh, and also getting the pro to pay on time, which from a cash flow perspective was difficult. So, you know, selling them £3,000 worth of gear is one thing, but then giving them 60, 90 day credit and then actually getting paid on day 90. So you could again, go and buy your more, you know, your next range of clothes that's coming out because the factories need to be paid and stuff needs to be designed, manufactured, put on a ship, sent across, you know, across the world to get to you. All of that process was an absolute nightmare.
Was it taking lesson. Up a lot of your time?
It, I mean, I wouldn't say it took up a lot of time. It took up a lot of headspace time. More to the point, we had enough staff to be able to cope with all of that. But just, you know, understanding that the boat that's going past Africa at the time to come through to be able to be in a position to pay the, you know, $1 million of stock that's on that boat, to realize that boat's actually on fire, to realize that they wouldn't allow that boat to dock because it was on fire, to then realize it has to come into a dry dock in London. So therefore, by the time the boat then, I mean, I can-
It's actually true. Is that all
100%
true?
100%
truth.
Oh,
yeah. My
goodness. We had a whole year's collection of clothes where the boat was on fire and it was coming into a dry dock and it couldn't go into a normal dock because it was going to take up too much time to fix the boat. So it went into a dry dock and they took each container off kind of manually with not the right crane system. So it took a month to get all of the containers off one by one instead of how they do them like really quite quickly today to then the stock was fine. But how many pro shops then when you've had a bad winter and their stock's 2 months late where give them an opportunity to cancel the orders? Oh, I mean, listen, it's a hard business, and anyone that thinks that they can get into the clothing business that we thought we could get in and be super successful, it was too much hard work for the actual return that it was given compared to what you could earn on the golf course.
That's the thing. If you go and win a couple of events, that's going to make in a year.
Well, didn't you win almost straight after kind of shutting the business down? Didn't you end up doing really well at the players?
Well, we decluttered a lot of things going in and around, not just obviously the clothing line, but, you know, taking things back to how they were originally managed in day one. Mistakes were being made from another agency that were helping out, which caused a lot of stress, financial stress and mistakes being made. And just, you know, too much was going on at the time and too many things were going wrong and, you know, building houses and houses that you had to move out of because, a few things had to change. We changed them. We simplified the whole process of what it was we were doing and it made a massive difference.
Yeah. I want to get into golf now a bit more. I feel like we've dived loads into you as an individual, which people listening and watching will be absolutely loving all of this. What's the best shot you've hit in your career? What's the have you got a number one best shot you've hit?
There will be a few that come to mind, but probably the most valuable shot I ever hit was at Pals in Spain. It was in trying to get through to final stage of qualifying. And
what year was this?
1998.
Okay.
18th hole, par 5, trees at about, I don't know, 370 yards off the tee in the middle of the fairway that overhang. Your driver off the tee, I pushed it right in the trees. I had to make par basically I knew I had to make par to get through and hit it right in the trees. I had to chip it back out in the fairway because I mean, around there it's, you know, it's the old kind of Spanish tree line courses. It was like here really where you can't really advance it too far. And I had about 230 yards to go, but the trees were kind of, you know, they were in my way now. So I had to flight it perfectly high enough to get over these trees. And I remember hitting this 2-iron absolute, you know, absolutely flush to about 25 feet. But, you know, so many things could have gone wrong at that time. And my career might have been in a very different place.
Oh, my God.
Had this 2-iron. I mean, tour school is probably the most stressful week of your life.
We covered it a number of years ago in Spain at Lumina. I think it's changed name now. But, yeah, there was a lot of stressful golfers there trying to qualify. How crazy is that, though, in all of that time frame, one of your most memorable shots or the best shots was 25 years ago.
But that was what was the stepping stone to put me on my journey to play golf. I mean, you know, if that 2-iron just clips the tree, so many ifs in that scenario, which sets you back another year, and then, you know, what other setbacks could have happened at the time, and, you know, you just never know. So I think, you know, it's easy to turn around and say, oh, hole in a putt here, right? Which everyone remembers, but it's sometimes the shot that no one ever saw that you hit that meant so much in the bigger picture of what it was.
I think that's it, though, because if you think about it, and that's all twofold, not only has that shot literally got you into the next stage of final qualifying, but you've now got that shot in your locker as such in the positive memory that you knew when the pressure was really on, you've hit that golf shot and you pulled it off and got through that moment, if you like. So, you know, moving forward in your career now, when the pressure's on, you've done it before and you can do it. And that must be super important as well and help you.
I almost call it like an archive.
Mm.
So with how you've described it is exactly how I would memorize every shot I've ever hit. Now, obviously, I can't remember every single shot I've ever hit. But you either do remember the really good shots or you do, unfortunately, remember the really bad shots.
Mm.
All of which I would turn around and put them in a filing cabinet.
Yeah.
And if you ever have to pull on them, it's good to go into the top drawer rather than the bottom drawer and say, right, well, I know I've hit this one before because I've hit it a number of times, but these are the great. So like you fill yourself full of positive energy and positive thoughts going into playing a really stressful shot or a really hard shot, because you know, you've got 1.4, 1.5 seconds really to be able to do what you need to do to produce that shot. So you better have the pre-thought mentality that you're capable of pulling that shot off. And hopefully you pull the one out the top drawer and not the bottom drawer.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, it makes so much sense. Do you... And again, great for our listeners and viewers. Do you do anything post round? Do you have like a little book? Do you write good shots down? Do you verbalize it? Is there anything that you do that helps file those good shots?
Well, James, my agent, team principal, friend, confident, everything, who's sitting in the room would have an archive because he writes everything down and notarizes everything. But, you know, I don't generally write stuff down. I perhaps should have wrote a lot of things down, but that's where I pull it from memory.
Yeah.
In terms of what it is I do, in terms of what I do pull from archiving stuff, and is video content. So video is, you know, quite important for me to video my swing every single week that I play. So if ever there's a week or a tournament that I'm going to, and there's a certain feeling or there's a shot shape that I'm hitting currently now, but I want to kind of blend back to how I was playing on a certain given week, like the Players' Championship when I finished runner-up. You know,
that shot from the trees was absolutely ridiculous.
116 yards.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
It was, it was a little silly, very silly. The shot that got me in there was a bottom draw shot.
Well, yeah, that was a Tommy Tank, and then you followed it up with that. I mean, that was ridiculous. So you nearly hold it. How it didn't go in.
There was a little V window split in the tree. So, you know, albeit I was covered in beer because I was so far right and so far near the hospitality area that everyone was drinking lots. And I remember walking up to the shot and this woman turned around and backed into me and
no,
hoofed a load of beer on me, and then she's like, I hate him.
So that gave you the confidence you needed.
So I was like,
maybe you got a bit of that beer in you. Maybe that just gave you a little bit of confidence.
I'll show her.
I think it was more to the point of, right, I'm going to stuff this in there.
How you hit that shot after a shank is beyond me. Oh, it's I've ridiculous. Done it everywhere.
Like you, shanks are part and parcel of my career. I can name them. Fourth hole at the Masters when Fanny was caddying for me, when my caddy at the time was having a baby, and I had two on that day. I had it on the fourth hole, straight right, lost ball, just re-tee. Had it on the 15th that week, and ended up missing the fairway left on 17 from the middle of the fairway on 15.
So you did compensate that time.
It was a proper shank over the trees.
Oh, sorry, you hit one that went over to the right. Sorry,
over the trees and went up over.
My days.
And I nearly holed out from there. I've had one on 7. I've had one on 10.
To go back to your point, you're almost drawing down on that confidence that after you hit a shank, the chances are you're probably going to hit a pretty special one coming straight back.
Here's my philosophy on a shank. People are bothered with what everyone else is thinking because you've had a shank. I couldn't give a rat's about what anyone else thinks. Everyone else has had a shank. Everyone in the world has had a shank. I don't care about having a shank. It doesn't matter. Just let's get on with the game of golf. Like, let me recover from wherever this ball's ended up.
It's a good mindset.
And crack on. Look, you're swinging a golf club at 100 mile an hour and you've got a 3 or 4 inch face to hit it on, right? I mean, I hit them out the toe. I hit them a bit low on the face, hit them a bit high. And occasionally we hit one out the hill. Hopefully you don't have 2 million a year and hopefully you don't have that many in a really important moment is the bit where it gets difficult.
the players.
One of the questions I had for you then, Ian, is that obviously you're a Live player and last year I went to Live London for the first event, see what it was like. And I came back and said, there was parts of it that I kind of really enjoyed. We said on the podcast a number of weeks ago that Rick was going to come to London for his first Live event. Are you still keen, Rick?
Yeah, I am. We've got tickets through today.
I want you to explain to Rick what you think he will feel on site and how it's different to maybe a normal kind of DP World Tour event.
Sure. First and foremost, I can't wait for you to come. Hopefully you're going to have your Majestics hat on and not a Four Aces hat or Fireballs hat. As you like free gear, now you can give it away if you like, but I mean, it'd be nice to see you wear a nice Majestics hat there.
Just because I'm under contract, unfortunately, with Lionel Scott, I will happily give this away. Who's your arch enemy team at the moment? Have you got like a team?
We are currently not in a position of saying we have an arch enemy team because in the table of, let's call it the Premiership, right? We're kind of low down and we obviously want to move up. So I wouldn't really say we've got an arch enemy. We would like to be in the top spot.
Yeah.
There is enormous value in being in the top three. And that is what we set out to achieve at the start of the year. We're not doing what we think we are capable of doing. So we need to move up.
So going back to Guy's point there, I'm Live London this year. From what I've seen on YouTube and etc. It appears like a very different type of crowd that are going to Live. Would that be fair to say?
I would say your demographic is a little younger, which is good. You'll hear music on the golf course, which I think all of us play golf generally casually with some form of music playing. A lot of people travel with a little speaker in the bag, so we got music in a golf car.
Certainly popular in America, isn't it?
Very popular. That you'll see on the golf course, that I think is a really cool relaxed vibe. You have the ability to watch, I think, because there's only 48 players instead of, two waves of, say, 78 players playing, you can reverse walk around the golf course and see every single player in the entire field in a short space of time. That you don't have the beauty in any normal regular tournament because they're kind of spaced out either morning or afternoon draw, and that kind of takes up the entire day. Great hospitality in various areas around the golf course. Again, good food. You can have a drink. It's a bit more, like a family orientated type venue situation. Again, because 48 players in and around the driving range everyone's on the range at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
Because it's a shotgun start. So there are so many cool things that make it and distinguish it as being different. Two tournaments in one tournament.
Yeah.
The fact of the leaderboard being able to not only show you, you know, an individual leaderboard, but you've obviously got the team aspect if you're a team follower,
yeah,
where you want to see, you know, your team move up during the week. So there are so many cool things, I think, within, you know, LIV Golf's concept that works so well, not just for us as players, but obviously for the fan following as well.
Well, that was one thing. And we had a little brief chat before the podcast started. It's been no secret that we've had very mixed opinions on LIV. We've liked some things, we've not liked some things, and that's something we kind of stand by. But when I came back from the LIV London event, and I think I said this on the podcast many times, there was lots I was impressed by. Firstly, the kind of tented village area, the food was great. It was a good atmosphere. It was a different demographic, like you said. It was kind of golfy, but not too golfy, if that makes sense. And one thing that stood out to me massively, whether it be the same this year or not, I don't know, but how actually close you could get to the players. Like, obviously, you were there, Phil Mickelson was there, DJ, these huge, huge names. And it did feel quite kind of personal. So if you are a fan of golf and you want to see these guys up close and personal, there's not many better places, I would say, than the LIV events, to be fair.
Yep, I agree. Look, it's a great viewing event to be able to go to. Concerts after the round of golf as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't have to be a mega golfy fan mm-hmm. to realize that there's a great name playing in the concert. So as soon as the round of golf finishes, you can walk straight to the stage area and obviously, you know, hang out, have a beer and, you know, enjoy a great concert, which we've done at various times as well. In Adelaide, Fisher was playing.
And then you do a shoey. Did you do a shoey?
I ended up doing a shoey, yeah, which was disgusting.
I've never quite understood that concept.
Nor have I.
I wouldn't even drink out my own shoe.
I hate feet as well. I have a really big problem with feet, and especially someone else's smelly feet.
So you must have had a few already before you did that.
I had a couple, so it probably made it a bit easier to do. Yeah.
What have you as a player enjoyed most about joining LIV?
There's so much. There are so many positives in how I view LIV as to what it's given me the opportunity to do. It's given me a lot more family time. A lot of people are going to take this back and, you know, you're just making lots more money. That is one aspect of obviously the original attraction is we're playing for a lot of money per week. So let's get that one and let's cover that one straight away. Yes, we're paid. Even if you don't play very well and you finish last, you're still going to get paid.
I think people respect you saying that, though.
Do you feel like a few too many players maybe weren't as open about that when they first signed?
I think that's the case.
Look, for sure, it was a big piece of it, right? People only turned around and said it was money, money, money situation. Look, that is one part of the situation, but after experiencing LIV for 18 months in this position that we're in, and we understood the business model as it was coming into LIV, that to own a piece of a franchise excites me as a business owner anyway, and someone that's had a real interest, you know, not just within golf, but outside in other aspects of business, to be able to try and grow a franchise business, to be able to be part of a team, to be able to travel with a team, to be able to spend time, not just with teammates, but the people in and around the team that run the team, to work with some of the best trainers, physios, to help you get prepared in a way where you haven't done it as good as you possibly could have done. To tee off at the same time, knowing your tee time before you start the week means you can plan your whole week. To bring on a new kind of a different audience of sponsors and a different group of sponsors and corporate people that you can finally entertain them in a way where you've never been able to entertain them ever before. A PGA Tour event or European Tour event or any tour event, normally you don't ever really get any sponsorship time where we can control our sponsors and we can control their guests in a way where we can give them the most incredible golf experience that they're probably ever going to have at any golf event. Because that's part of Team Majestic's ability to give that level of experience. And that's what people want nowadays. So You know, booking your travel months and months and months in advance, knowing when you can book a return flight because you know your tee off time on a Sunday. It's little things like that, which sound kind of silly in a way when you say it, but you know,
after spending 25 years not doing that,
well, you don't know when your tee time is. Yeah. You don't know what flight you can catch. You don't know, you know, in and around where you're going to be able to book a dinner table. You don't know what time you. So this, I mean, there's, you know, there are so many little pieces of the puzzle of what goes into a normal week. How you're going to, you know, how you're properly going to prepare because of that. Obviously, we don't have that early tee time anymore on a Thursday, Friday, which is a huge deal in terms of rest and recovery.
And do you feel like, therefore, when players are out on the golf course all at the same time, there's no huge advantage? Like, as in,
what zero, I mean, advantage.
You know, you don't get an early tee off and suddenly the wind was quieter or whatever. Yeah. It wouldn't be fair if I didn't ask, what are you missing and what do you not enjoy as much?
What am I missing? Friends. Obviously, friends that you've spent 20 years, some of which 25 years of your life with, week in, week out. You know, that would be a part of LIV, which only having 48 players, you can't have 150 players, so therefore you're going to miss some people. But I don't miss 155, but you're going to miss a few. So to be able to have that, you know, and continue those relationships away from the golf course sometimes has always been difficult anyway, because they have a life, I have a life, and you don't really see them week in, week out. So I miss that aspect. It's probably, to be honest, it's probably just that. You know, the staff, some of the staff, referees, people that you've had relationships with for a very long time. That, you know, you just miss saying hello to.
Kind of sounds like leaving a job in a way, like leaving for one business to go to another business. It might be more money, it might be better flexibility, it might be more working from home, whatever it might be. If you see that's a better opportunity for you, it is. But equally, you might then miss someone that you should go and see every day that you'd walk in, who's a receptionist or whatever like that.
Yeah, but you know, the bigger picture of this was always going to be, you know, we knew we were playing for 14 weeks a year because that's what we sign up to play for. But the European Tour allowed a minimum of, you had to play a minimum of four events. So there was always the ability to play European Tour events as well as playing LIV events. That was obviously going to be difficult to do that on the PGA Tour because the minimum is 15. Mm. He wasn't going to then go and play 29 events plus the majors, could be 33. That's too many. So, you know, we didn't know at the time that by playing LIV, it was going to be, you know, heavily frowned upon in a way where therefore, you know, you were going to get penalized and punished and suspended and all of that stuff. But, you know, that was the unknown. We'd asked questions and, you know, what if we take the opportunity to play? You know, the answer was never given what was going to happen. So, the hope was LIV was going to be accepted into the picture of golf, that there would be an agreement in place, which obviously is going to be talked about over the coming months to see how exactly that's going to work out now. So, very thankful in a way that it's come to that position where the guys have, you know, clearly the smart business people have got together and kind of seen that, you know, LIV should stay. LIV can stay, and there is a coming together under an umbrella agreement, which is going to be worked out.
I was going to say, how do you feel like the future of that is, the future of golf in general and professional golf is going to look over the next few years?
We don't know. I mean, obviously that's all to be discussed, I think, in the coming months. So being part of LIV and being part of, you know, a golf fan as such, it's exciting. I think from my perspective that there is an acceptance out there. There is an acceptance that, you know, LIV is a good product, that we can give something out to the golf fan, which is good. It's going to be accepted. And how does that look in 12 months? I don't know. Like I'm excited to see, you know, potentially that where they get to with the agreement and how they're going to place the tournaments in the places where they should be. And, you know, we can hopefully get, you know, get more and more fans involved in the game of golf to give over several different forms of product with DP World and PGA Tour and Live Golf. So it's kind of let's see how the next 3 months pans out.
It does certainly seem like there's a huge turning of the tides. Just the last few weeks, it feels like conversations that are starting to take place. Obviously, US Open last week, and the way that players are even being with each other, it feels like the friction is being softened. That's what it feels like from the outside. I'm not sure if you can talk about that from the inside, whether you've experienced any of that. But also, I wonder what that's going to look like, let's say, over the next few years. Like, how I'm just so intrigued to know, and I'm sure as a fan, but as a player, as players, you're all a bit like, God, how does this all pan out for me? What's my future going to look like? For example, like, is there going to be a future where Live players can now start to be accepted back into Ryder Cup from a European side of things? You know,
well, hopefully.
Because I'm guessing that must be a huge life goal for yourself to be Ian Poulter, Ryder Cup captain.
Absolutely. You know, you can't play 8 Ryder Cups and not want to be part of a Ryder Cup. So, you know,
by the way, not only play 8 Ryder Cups, to be a frigging legend on the European team, like the most decorated, aren't you the most decorated individual points?
Well, Sergio's won the most points.
But is it not individual matches? Aren't you the number one?
Well, I've never lost a singles match. I don't think Monty's lost one either.
I mean, that's pretty ridiculous. I mean, I want to dive into this a little bit more, but like, your Ryder Cup history is incredible.
And I think that would also be what's transcended you into a household name. Like, I think a lot of non-golfers clearly know who Ian Poulter is. And I think that comes from 100%. That kind of Ryder Cup legacy.
Yeah, it's been a big part of my 25 years on tour. I think when I look back at my first one, 2004, and all of the ones that I've subsequently played, and, you know, Medina being notable for...
Medina was ridiculous.
Notice of all for, you know, the Saturday afternoon comeback and Sunday, being picked and being under the scrutiny because Faldo picked me, and, you know, winning 4.5 points in that Ryder Cup, and Paris beating Dustin Johnson, world number one in singles, who just wouldn't roll over. Kept holding 50 footer on, 70 footer on, 40 footer. And Ryder Cup has been a huge part of my tour career. I think today, people still want to talk about that today. I did a luncheon yesterday afternoon, and Ryder Cup was a big topic, mm-hmm. Which come up, and Medina come up again. So, I mean, you know, that was 11 years. That was 11 years ago, and it's still a huge topic. So, look, I think for me, we can talk about Ryder Cup for hours, right? I can bore all of the listeners on Ryder Cup, but, you know, the hope in all of this, I think, the coming together, the merge of how that agreement's going to play out, is exciting from a Ryder Cup standpoint.
Yes.
Hopefully, it makes sense. And again, I don't know the details of how exactly this is going to pan out. And
mm-hmm. Of course,
you know,
but that's a dream of yours for that to happen.
If I ever get in a position and things smooth themselves out in enough to be able to help out in a Ryder Cup, let's say from an experience standpoint, from a standpoint of being able to be in that position for the fans as well, for what you've been able to help out, would be an absolute dream of mine.
I think 3 weeks ago, I would have said that was never a possibility. I think since the conversation of merger, it was almost the first thing that came to my mind. Does this mean, hopefully, touch wood, you know, water can go under the bridge, and then there might be a possibility of having Ian Poulter as a Ryder Cup captain, Lee West was a Ryder Cup captain, Sergio Garcia as a Ryder Cup captain, Henrik Stenson again, Ryder Cup captain. That has to happen. Graham McDowell, Ryder Cup captain, Martin Kaymer, like the list of captains there. And vice captains, etc., of all the experience of everything that all of you have done for the Ryder Cup in excelling it to the level it's at now, there has to be a future. Please, that where I know it's not on you. I know it's not on you, and I'm not saying on you. But if you could do it, hard, though. But like, and I know that the I'm sure the comments. Yeah, but the guys knew that when they were gonna. But also, you might not know.
To be honest, we didn't know because we asked the question numerous times. You know, we don't have to go into the detail of that, but we asked if we were gonna, look at playing 14 live events a year, what would that mean? And there was no answer. So there was no this is how things are going to lay themselves out. So it's very hard. It's very difficult to make a decision, make decisions without knowing all of the detail at play. So you can only deal with the detail in front of you, and that's obviously what we did. And the hope moving forward is that the powers that be in the game of golf and the smart business people that help and advise with inside this great game of golf are now sitting around the same table, which is good. It's kind of a shame it's taken as long as it took to get to this position. But I think as a player, as a golf fan, I think it's exciting that, they are sitting around the table. They can have a sensible level-headed conversation today and hopefully set aside obviously the emotions at play and do the right thing for the business side of the game of golf for the fans at mind.
Last thing, I've got to blame you for something.
Yep.
Back in Medina. I got kicked out of a sports bar because of you.
Did you?
Yeah.
Good on you.
Sourced up.
Sourced up.
Yeah.
Watching Medina.
Did you ever rare up with an American fan?
No, it's worse than that.
Go on.
I got kicked out of this golf simulator bar, sports bar, watching the Ryder Cup because whether it was when you held a putt, or I think it was when you held a putt, or someone held a putt against you, I think it was. Who did you play in singles at Medina again?
Webb Simpson.
He held a putt against you on the back nine, and I picked up a Scotch egg. That was on the table.
In Medina?
No, I was in this golf simulator bar in Manchester. I picked up this Scotch egg and I threw it at the screen at Webb Simpson. But I was in so much anger that I got kicked out. I think I missed. But I might have hit you. I got kicked out of this sports bar. And the very next day, because it was a friend of mine, I had to go around. And as an apology, I took a little box of Scotch eggs around and apologised.
As the apology?
I just thought it'd be quite ironic.
Okay, salt in the wound. But anyway, that's a great note to end on.
Thank you, Ian. We're going to get out and play some golf.
Really enjoyed that.
Anything else you want to cover? Anything else you want to get off your chest?
That's an hour and a half, and we could probably do this for about 4 hours. So let's do a part two.
Let's do it again.
Let's do it in Orlando.
Oh wow,
done. Late
we
no
we do it in the museum.
Okay,
with all the Ryder Cup stuff.
I must admit,
can I come to that?
I've not even. Of course, you can.
Please, Ian.
I've not. If I lose today, I'll let you drive one of the Ferraris.
I've not even.
We're going.
I had about all the Clark collection on my list, and I didn't even get into that because that's another crazy world.
Keep people waiting for part two.
Ian, thanks for your time. Thanks to Woburn. Thanks to Paul the Chef for this 8.8 sausage roll.
I want to apologise now and say that they really like them.
I'll apologise to the chef who cooked the original one.
Can you just say now the sound?
I'm going to apologise to Paul.
Rick Shields recommends Woburn sausage rolls. Just have a little soundbite.
Hi, I'm Rick Shields and I recommend Woburn sausage rolls.
Perfect.
Right, guys, thanks for watching, listening. Make sure you follow Ian on all of his socials. I'm sure you do. 6.1 million views we want on this match. And we'll see you all soon. Peace.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.